Senate Committee on Judiciary, Tuesday, April the 22nd, 1975, 8 a.m., room 407A. Work session on Senate Bill 803, 862, 863, 884, 980, 983, House Bill 2252. Prosecutor
misconduct.
It's the evidence, of course, that ultimately is critical.
Right, but the evidence was admissible is the point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, evidence was admissible.
The rule with respect to what evidence is admissible or inadmissible is, generally speaking, for state law to decide. And the only limitations thereon are that the rules of admissibility or inadmissibility may not violate due process standards.
I have no problem on that, except that I find no statutes whatsoever barring this type of evidence, and it's my substantial fear that the barring of this evidence would be a deprivation of due process. But anyway, that was denied, and they said, and this supports your last notion. Here's the language of the court. Well, under the law of Maryland, specific acts of misconduct are inadmissible to impeach a witness's credibility, and specific acts of intercourse are inadmissible to establish the prosecutor's consent. You want to say prior inconsistent statements, there's no problem there. That's just ordinary impeachment. And evidence of general reputation for unchastity are admissible to impeach a witness's credibility. It's always admissible, of course, to show prior inconsistent statements.
Always.
Because no problem there. But they go on to mention here, evidence of general reputation for unchastity are admissible to impeach the witness's credibility. Then we've got the case that I raised during, not the work session, I wasn't here, unfortunately, the case that I raised during the general session, Hicks versus Hyatt. It was a military case where under military law this was admissible, and the citation on that, the citation on the first case is 386 U.S. at 66. Hicks versus Hyatt was a military case reported as 64 Federal Supplement 238. Under military law this was available. The defense counsel knew it. He didn't offer it, and the court said
it was a denial of counsel to the point where he's entitled habeas corpus.
In fact, it was denial of due process. Well, they didn't put it on that grounds. They said evidence as to Mrs. Murray's reputation for chastity was necessary for a proper determination of the matter before the court-martial. The military procedure required this evidence to be produced before and to be received by the court-martial. The procedure was breached, and therefore Hicks was denied due process of law.
Neither case stands for any proposition that constitutional law requires that such evidence be admissible. Both cases simply stand for the proposition that once evidence is admissible.
Yes.
Once evidence is admissible, under the law of the jurisdiction in which the trial occurs, the failure of a defense attorney to pursue it may constitute a denial of due process because of ineffective assistance of counsel, or the failure of the state to disclose evidence which is deleterious to the state's case may constitute a Brady versus Maryland problem. That's all.
I appreciate this does not address itself to the fact, can we constitutionally make such evidence inadmissible?
All right. I don't think it even implies that we cannot. For instance, my own view would be that 49 states, the District of Columbia, and all of the territories, both incorporated and unincorporated, could make it admissible. If we could not, there would be no constitutional problem. Unanimity among the states is not required, nor is it usually even given much thought. There's an occasional time when the Supreme Court has mentioned the fact that states were virtually unanimous in allowing this or that, and they thought that was important. Betts versus Brady comes to mind with respect to that problem, for instance, under the older decisions. But this just doesn't touch upon the constitutional admissibility question. And it seems to me the state is entitled to determine as a matter of its own evidentiary law that there is so little probative value available in general reputation for chastity with respect to whether or not a particular act or acts occurred that such information will simply not be available as evidence.
I appreciate these don't go directly to that point, but I find no cases to support that notion, and then we're given.
I don't think there are any.
It's a general proposition.
I
hear you.
We'll probably make the first one.
Then there's Coles versus Peyton, Court of Appeals, Fourth Circuit, Virginia case, and trying to see what the proposition was there. Basically, again, under Virginia law, the evidence was relevant. It was not admitted, and they held. In that case, the defense counsel didn't push it, and they held deprivation of counsel.
Yeah, that's a federal habeas corpus case.
Yeah. Now the one that really disturbs me is this last one.
Afraid you were saving the worst for last.
Yeah. Here's a situation where the plaintiff, the prosecutrix, the prosecutrix is physiologically a virgin. The prosecution puts this in. Defendant complains that this was inadmissible, and they hold that it's highly probative. That the synopsis says evidence of the prior chastity of the complaining witness in the rape case. The testimony of the complaining witness that's not good. Precise issues. One is first impression. We hold that the challenge evidence is admissible. We think the jury could have found from the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the complaining witness lack of physical resistance and her apparent passive compliance. I'm not seeing the language here. But basically the holding was that evidence of affirmative evidence of chastity on the part of the prosecutrix was good prosecution evidence. This statute would not even permit that, as I read it. The testimony of complaining witness and a physician that she was a virgin prior to this act was relevant and material to the issue upon which the prosecution had the burden of proof. And in this situation, it counterbalanced the inflammatory character of any of such testimony.
Well, again, that speaks to a question of evidentiary rules of criminal jurisdiction.
But
it seems to me that evidence. I'm trying to recall a specific language, 2241, as it's been sent to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But
this would indicate she couldn't put this in. The prosecution could not put in evidence of chastity.
What the prosecution could put in, though, is medical evidence, for instance, of tearing of vaginal tissues and so on, which amounts to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That does not constitute an insurmountable evidence.
This was not. But this was the physician's testimony. The testimony of the complaining witness, a physician that she was a virgin prior to the act, was relevant material.
Obviously is.
Okay.
What's our language, which you think would keep us from?
Okay. All right. I'll back off on that. Evidence, reputation, and character.
That's right. I don't understand
okay.
How
I've got no problem on that.
I should have thought just the opposite.
Right. Okay. I've got no problem on that one. Then.
All right. Committee should understand. We're making a kind of social experiment here. No other state, to my knowledge, has a law like this one. The Supreme Court is constantly giving lip service to the idea that the first 10 amendments are not supposed to be a straitjacket on the state's ability to socially experiment with the criminal law. And the passage of a measure like this one, it in fact, stretches and tests certain traditional concepts with respect to the manner in which a certain kind of case is prosecuted. But the concerns that arise necessarily arise out of cases which dealt with jurisdictions where such evidence was admissible, and therefore the failure to get it admitted or the failure to offer it in one way or another gave rise to separate and distinct due process problems. I'm not concerned about, as an appellate lawyer at least, I'm not concerned about selling the concept that this state is entitled to make this kind of experiment constitutional.
Okay.
Are you satisfied?
Yep.
Okay.
Chairman?
Yes.
Could I pursue that? Maybe answer it at the same time as well. If I understand correctly, you don't think there's any impediment in 2241 for the prosecution to offer the testimony or evidence as to the virginity of the prosecutor. Once that's put in issue, what can the defendant challenge that? Of course, if the prosecutor...
You don't mean the prosecution.
Yeah.
Victim.
The victim.
If the state puts on affirmative evidence to the effect
of the prosecutor. The victim. I call it the prosecutor.
Of course, that's part of the problem we have with this whole thing. She's the complainant.
Yeah.
We keep calling her the prosecutor, and that's the wrong approach.
That's a little male chauvinism.
That's right. It really is. It hurts the analysis. She's the victim.
Okay.
In the same way that any other assault victim is the victim.
That's a good point. I stand corrected.
A thing that hurts.
Now, the prosecutor then puts in evidence to establish the coercion or the likelihood there was not consent or whatever, the virginity of the victim. Is the defendant then entitled to counter that evidence with any testimony as to her previous
Those are two different kinds of evidence. One is lack of coercion on the one hand, and that's what the proposed statute speaks to, as I recall. Second is the prosecutor affirmatively goes forward and claims that the girl was a virgin. Tearing of certain vaginal tissues and so on, and offers affirmative testimony from the doctor that the girl had never had sexual relations at all, ever, and the girl herself testifies to that effect. She may be impeached by evidence with respect to prior sexual contact with almost anybody, it seems to be then, because that's impeachment matter not offered substantively.
And the issue of coercion.
And it's an issue, and it doesn't go to coercion at all. It goes to the veracity of the witness, period.
So it's on the issue of consent, not on the issue of consent. So this would be limited to the issue of consent.
It doesn't reach the issue of consent at all. As I recall the wording of the bill, I don't have the wording.
The bill says for any purpose.
Yes. Well, okay, then maybe we've foreclosed it.
I think we have.
Well, in that case, maybe we've also made a mistake. I'll tell you part of the reason I wonder, though, about whether a judge would keep it out anyway. Let me see.
That's... can't conceive of it coming about.
Oh, I can.
Can you?
Yeah.
Medical testimony? Okay.
Can't you, John?
Yeah.
Pretty readily, as a matter of fact.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The bill's up to date.
Right. Evidence of the character or reputation for chastity of the complainant is not admissible for any purpose, and reference to the character or reputation for chastity of the complainant should not be made in the presence of the jury. That's subsection 2.
It's up to me.
Except as provided in subsection 4, evidence of previous sexual conduct of a complainant shall not be admitted in reference to that conduct shall not be made in the presence of the jury. I regard that language as being different. It doesn't say for any purpose there. It just simply says you will not offer such evidence. And I would think that any judge would say, based upon, if not the latest case, is Oregon versus Hawes, I think he'd say that the constitutional proposition is, generally speaking, that impeachment is a separate breed of cat. Someone comes forward and affirmatively makes a silly claim, the defense is always entitled to impeach by showing that that is a lie. If that's true for the state, it's got to be true for the defense.
Mick, we've also got the problem of character or reputation. Why is it just character or the reputation? What's the word character or at?
That's the only way the evidence is ever offered.
It's reputation. Is character evidence proven by reputation?
That's right.
Well, character or reputation.
Well,
sounds
we phrase it
redundant.
That way because the question is normally put to the witness: are you familiar with
reputation?
Are you familiar with the reputation of the complaining witness as to her character? Or,
right.
You know, we've
sure,
got it in there backwards. But are you familiar with her reputation for character or chastity? Either one.
Well, it should be evidence.
Yes, I am, and then the question is, what is it?
Shouldn't this be read evidence of the reputation?
Well, No, pardon me, pardon me. What this is talking about is you can put the question two ways. Are you familiar with are you familiar with the chaste character of the victim? And that's an objectionable question in Oregon, but it would not be in some places.
I don't think
that's
any
part
place
of the language has arisen.
I can't find any evidence that opinion as to specific
character. Chaste character used to be required. That used to be what you had to affirmatively show before the person could be the victim. And that's why the language keeps showing up in the opinion. Character, even because you had to show chaste character of the victim. It was difficult for a widow or a divorced woman, for instance, to be raped because she was not of chaste character. I'm not really answering your question.
Well, it seems to me that the word character or simply is, if not redundant, is confusing. Evidence of the reputation. That's really the only type of evidence in this area that's admissible.
Well, character or chastity, if you take the words reputation, what you're saying is it's just bad English.
Yes. It sounds like two things.
And
could be.
Well, it could, and maybe you better think about that for a minute. For instance, have we foreclosed? I should have thought of this. I'm sorry, I didn't. Reference to the character, strike out the words or reputations for chastity in terms of analysis. Statute. Reference to the character of the complainant. How about character for truth and veracity?
Yeah, you don't want to get rid of that.
We don't want to get rid of that. The words character or probably should be stricken.
Yes.
What do you think, John?
I didn't even see that. If it talks in terms of veracity,
yeah.
Character, then you're really
that's
in trouble.
That's not what we intended. That's not what any of us intended.
Of course, I read character for chastity, but
that's not a construction I can defend once I examine the language specifically. The words character or I think should be stricken.
Are you thinking about bringing it back from
4 days after? I was having basic problems with what I felt was the constitutionality of precluding the defendant from that.
Wally had a third problem.
We solved that.
Got a couple
well, Phoebe's going to attack it, I
guess. That's one problem.
That's the problem. Well, that's why
I'm
want to solve this
with,
problem.
Yeah, that's the only thing I'm worried about. I'm comfortable about the problem Phoebe's going to attack it on, as I understand.
Which is?
429.
Yeah, the inability or failure to incorporate some of the aspects of 429 into 2241 or to adopt.
I'm not familiar with it.
Primarily, if I understand the concern was whether or not the hearing should be pre-trial as opposed to being at the time of trial.
Well, I've got no problem with the procedure for that.
That accomplishes nothing, is the answer to that, it seems to me.
The thing I'm concerned about, though, is that Walt's concerned.
Yeah.
If we raise these issues and Ed raises his issue, then it's going to come back, I think. And the question I have is, in the rape case, if in fact the virginity of the victim is frequently put on by the prosecution.
Well, not frequently,
no.
But it is.
There are half a dozen cases.
It happens.
Okay.
It happens.
But if it's more than a rare bird to see it on there, then it would seem to me the defendant, if that's part of the state's case, and it goes not to the whether or not the plaintiff is truthful or not, it goes to the question of whether the likelihood of force or compulsion or coercion, I would think. I don't know what it's for, or maybe the fact that the act took place or some such thing. But what I'm getting at is
what's the purpose for which the evidence is offered? It's corroboration of the claim that the act occurred.
Okay. But if I'm a defendant and I have reason to know that the doctor was wrong, that in fact it was not her first act of intercourse, and she contends that it is, that gets into the area of impeachment.
I'm a little surprised the doctor could offer such evidence. It's normally the girl herself who's going to make the claim. The doctor, the testimony from the doctor is normally, I found evidence of tearing of the hymen and of other damage to vaginal tissue. From that doctor, were you able to draw a conclusion with respect to the nature of the assault on this victim? Yes, I was of the opinion she had not had prior sexual experience. This was her initial sexual experience. A physician will sometimes offer such an opinion. Frequently, they will not, because hymen need not be torn in the sexual intercourse, for one thing. And other such tearing is not necessarily proof that it's the first time. Some doctors will offer such testimony, some won't. It's going to depend on the age of the victim, and a number of other physiological factors. But it is not unheard of to offer such testimony, at least in my own experience.
See what I'm getting at, though? Well, the point I'm trying to reach is, if that's the case, do we block the defendant from offering any evidence converting?
I don't think the language of this bill does.
Okay.
Now, are you satisfied?
If the words character or were eliminated, I'd feel comfortable. I appreciate we're making an experiment.
John, do you have any comment?
No, I don't, Madam Chairman. I think that would be advisable.
I apologize to the committee. It's something I should have noticed tonight.
Well, then the consensus is to bring him back and move on.
Is it really that important? Maybe the character certainly has an influence on reputation.
Well, there's a completely different kind of character we're talking about here.
Could be.
Reputation for truth and veracity, for instance. And
but that could be a factor in the trial for impeachment.
Well, the point is, the way it's written now, it could arguably be claimed that the bill forecloses offering such testimony with respect to reputation for truth and veracity, too. And I don't think you want to foreclose that.
Okay.
That's my point.
Oh, okay. That because
would,
it's
that
in there in the negative.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it is important. You can take it from the desk.
Consensus to bring it back?
If we bring it back, we're going to get bombarded with the putting some 4229 out to it.
What is the other thing?
What is the other thing?
What's the other matter?
One of them is the allowing the pretrial determination.
Yeah, right.
And the other one is the weight of the evidence.
Oh, you can't do that. You can't. That is unconstitutional. You can't do that.
Well, those are the two things they want.
Okay. That weighing of the evidence business is just a now, constitutional
position. Have we already, did we make any amendments in this bill?
Yes, we did.
Well, then we can do it in conference committee, can't we? Strike the character.
We put an emergency clause on it.
Yeah, which throws it in the conference. I'm a little worried about that, Madam Chairman. I think people have been singularly unsuccessful in urging that it will be fixed in conference committee or any other house. This session used to work.
I don't think it'll ever come up on the floor.
Can't
unless
we make an amendment this morning and get the amendment distributed? I can't get it printed, huh? Could we get a typewritten amendment?
Doesn't it have to lay on the desk a day?
Yeah, an amendment desk.
You're sure you're right. I'm striking it.
Am I sure I'm right? I'm pretty sure. I'm as sure as I ever am about these problems.
And then the whole statute could be struck because of that?
No.
Oh, no. Just
no. Just that.
Those two words.
Just that. I think the rest of the thing is probably severable, but it creates such a problem.
That's true.
And no judge would ever follow the statute.
Madam Chairman, I just considering the history and the discussion of this bill, I don't think that it's going to say, assuming that this were enacted as is. First of all, I think that the interpretation is not clearly one way or the other. And secondly, I think if you were to go to the history of the discussion on the bill, I think a court would have to conclude that this did not preclude admission of character as to truth and veracity.
Certainly the discussion we've just had in here.
Well as say, the discussion when the committee considered the bill, I don't think that you can construe from that at all that there was any intent to preclude the admission of evidence that goes to the truth and veracity of a witness. It is ambiguous, but I think it would fly without taking the thing out. That's my feeling.
Well, let's see. As I recall, we've amended this by putting it in the section with respect to Reagan, too, haven't we? Yeah. Yeah, we can save it on appeal. I'd feel better with it out, but we can save it on appeal. The reason being that we've got it in there in that particular place. If we had done what it was the DA suggested, which was put it in the witness and evidence statutes, then we would have a problem. But it gets a lot easier this way, and the legislative history of both committees is uniform with respect to
what it is you're trying to do.
Well, Walt, the question's up to you, because I don't think anybody will raise it but you.
What's the danger of bringing it back and cleaning it up? Is there some impediment for a 48-hour delay in eliminating that? What's the reluctance? Why? Is it if it gets back here?
There's already steam going on. There's going to be a fight on the floor, and you give them more time.
I'm reasonably comfortable on that aspect, though. I think that.
Right, I am too, but if Walt's going to bring it up,
no,
then we can't.
I would go along with the consensus here. I just feel sloppy.
Frankly, if I could offer one more comment, I'm a little more concerned about the committee's reaction to this problem about that balancing test that you remember was in 429. If it looks like the Senate is seriously going to consider that something that ought to be in there, that would be a mistake. You just don't conduct that kind of balancing test in determining the admissibility of otherwise probative evidence tending to the acquittal of a defendant.
Be sure you mark the minutes what Bill was discussing.
You could really say there's an error and bring it back up.
What bill are we talking about?
There is opposition building to it, and the sooner it goes through, the better it's going to be.
What's wrong with the bill that's up there the way it is now?
Well, we've solved one problem in it. Bob, do you want to bring it back?
Well, I don't care. I'm trying to take care of Walt's problem.
I would prefer to have that cleaned out now. But I would not raise the question.
Shoulder to shoulder.
I'll support the experiment, although my common law barnacles are 4 inches thick.
983. Al Lowy.
My apologies for not catching it sooner.
Glad that you found it now at about 11 o'clock this morning.
What time do you meet for this?
Yeah. Senator Cruz.
2 minutes, Al.
All right, 983 authorizes the Circuit Court of Marion County upon motion by either party, primarily probably the Department of Justice, to hear a writ of habeas corpus proceeding other than in the Marion County Courthouse. The sections 1040, 1080, 1090, and 3070 all relate to the fact that the court shall sit in a specific place unless upon agreement of the parties. Well, obviously, we're going to have some trouble getting agreement of the inmates because the advantage of filing a writ of habeas corpus is a trip from 2605 State Street downstate to the courthouse. This would save a substantial amount of money. We have to bring one man down for a trial. We have to have two. For each additional man, we bring three men. We bring another man, so it just ties up in non-productive time. Correctional personnel sitting in Marion County Courthouse waiting to hear a habeas corpus. Another saving that would result therefrom is that in the habeas corpus proceedings now, most of the matters are conditions of confinement. This requires testimony of either officers, doctors, staff personnel. If we have to disprove an allegation, we have to hold again the OSP or Oregon Correctional Institution personnel at the courthouse until time to come on for their testimony. If we can hear them at the institutions, then of course we could just by phone say, okay, you're doing 5 minutes and not have them be away from their duties.
Are the judges in Marion County in agreement with the bill?
Judges in Marion County are in agreement with it. The basic question, what really gave rise to it, was Judge Barber had made a tour of the Oregon State Penitentiary in particular and had noticed the recently constructed hearing room that has been constructed out there to handle the disciplinary hearings and said, this is a reasonable facility, I wouldn't mind sitting out here. We had come up with a process of sitting out there, and because of these statutory provisions, we had felt that we'd be subject to challenge.
Is there a motion on the bill?
May I ask you to get an emergency clause, because just for money purposes, we didn't put it in.
Well,
the sooner we do it, the more money we save.
With emergency clause.
Okay, safe. You heard that.
Motion
safe.
Is to put an emergency clause on. Clerk, call the roll.
Mr. Brown?
Aye.
Carson? Cook.
Aye.
Aye.
Roberts.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 983 out, do pass as amended. Clerk call roll.
Brown.
Aye.
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 Roberts.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Aye. 980.
Madam Chairman, this is a bill which would delete the authority of a peace officer now to make an arrest for a major traffic offense based upon probable cause. If you recall, Senator Mahoney spoke on behalf of the bill. Kirk Carlson of the Portland Police and Captain Williams of the Oregon State Police opposed the bill.
It's a pleasure with the bill.
I move it out, do pass.
Senator Cook moves Senate Bill 980 out, do pass. Discussion?
I have some problems. Why should we take that authority away?
I might mention, Madam Chairman, that in Senate Bill 80, this authority was not provided, and it was placed back in the statutes of the special session at the request of law enforcement agencies.
Well, it just seems to me they don't really need it. It's been abused rather seriously by the police officers.
The instance in which it most frequently is used in a situation where you've got an accident which the police officer did not observe and he wants to charge the person with DUIL or .15, things like this. You're talking about, as I say, major traffic offenses, reckless driving, DUIL, .15, driving while suspended, attempting to elude and hit and run.
Those are the offenses that constitute Class A misdemeanors?
Yes.
I oppose the motion.
Further discussion? Clerk call roll.
Brown.
No.
Carson.
No.
Cook.
Aye.
Roberts.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Madam Chairman.
Aye. Motion fails.
And move the table.
Motion is to table 980. Clerk call roll.
Brown.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Cook.
No.
Roberts.
No.
Aye.
No. Motion failed.
That's called a standoff.
Okay. House Bill 2252. John?
This was a bill that would allow the Motor Vehicles Division to give registration number plates to law enforcement.
I'm going to make an arrest.
This would allow the Motor Vehicles Division to issue registration number plates which are not specifically marked or designated or may be associated with the state or governmental agency. The main purpose being to allow the use of a vehicle in law and undercover work by law enforcement agencies.
Seems like we just
gave Senator Brown?
I move it. We just gave permission to confiscate those cars.
Yeah,
like, we'll be able to get license plates.
All I gotta do is break the code on the regular series numbering.
Right. I gather this.
Any motions on the bill?
I move it. Do pass.
Senator Brown moves it out. Do pass. Discussion? Clerk call roll.
Aye.
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 No.
I don't care.
You already did it.
Can't vote, I don't care.
Yeah, where does that show on the computers?
Okay, he said aye.
Oh, Madam Chairman?
Aye. Senate Bill 863.
Madam Chairman, this was a bill on which Cecil Edwards testified in favor. There is in your packet a letter from Mick Gillette. At the time of the hearing, I think it was you, Madam Chairman, who asked Mick to submit the letter.
You want to go over it briefly, Mick?
have a copy of my own letter, but I can recall basically what it was I said. I suggested that, for the most part, the things that you're trying to avoid appear to already be covered by the bill, by the present statute, and I was concerned about the possible unconstitutionality of some of the broad language that was used in the balance of the measure.
But other than that, it was all right.
In addition to that, since disclosing information in the data system is one of the possible offenses, and since one could disclose only that which is collected from public sources such as newspapers, for instance, they're talking about computerizing the New York Times. To make it a crime to disclose that which appears in the media somewhere is certainly unconstitutional.
It ought to be done.
The fullest dissemination of such information may very well turn out to be important. Cox Broadcasting versus Cohen is a case I cited. It's actually, I think, 5 weeks old instead of six. But you can't do that.
Okay, I have two problems. One of the things this legislature is doing, we've had several bills, is we're redefining the definition. In other words, we're having sub-definitions. So we've got that in that competition bill that we heard yesterday, where, and I see that this is a choice we've done here in this one. We've broadened the definition of tamper and interfere. There was a problem with this Oregon State fellow, and it's either through the, I don't know whether you heard the testimony.
I did. Yeah, okay. I was here.
And we have considerable concern with our OLA system. As we become more dependent upon the computer, we're going to have to be able to preclude the monkey business that that Oregon State fellow got into. Is there any way we could tighten this up? I don't mean to speak for my colleagues, obviously, but I sense your letter has done irreparable damage to 863. I'm not necessarily, unfortunately, it may have saved us some embarrassment. But is there anything we can do to plug the hole? It was either an inept or a lack of enforcement on the part of the existing law, or there's a hole in the law.
I think it was inept enforcement.
Okay.
I think what he did was against the law.
John, is that why Senator Burbidge was here, do you know?
No, he was here on...
Okay. Is there a motion on this bill? Chair will move to table.
It seems to me that's a perfectly valid need that's being filled by the bill, but... maybe I missed something in the discussion. Wally, what your thought was?
Well, that's kind of the question I asked Mick, was that this was in existence at the time that the troop from Oregon State broke into the motor vehicle.
Sub 1 was in existence.
Yes.
Right.
But there was a general feeling at the time that whatever it either, and I'm not clear on whether it was just a reluctance, ineptness, or, but I got the feeling that we felt that we were exposed to an area that really wasn't criminal.
Cover.
And we couldn't get after. So I think that's the genesis of this particular piece of legislation. But I am concerned, as Mick points out in his second paragraph, that we've started to define the definition now, which gets a little cumbersome. And if it does, in fact, flirt with a recent Supreme Court decision, I don't think it should pass in its present form. The question I ask Mick is really, should we tamper with it more, or just given the deep six, and he was inclined to think that the present law.
I hadn't had a chance to read
the letter. The present law would protect us. I'd be inclined, Madam Chairman, to support your motion to table, but could we send a copy of this to Senator Burbidge and one to Cecil Edwards, the understanding that if they strongly disagree, they might want to talk with Nick and pass it out. We can bring it back if they do, but I would.
Sold.
Important, you understand?
Motion to table.
Send
copies to Burbidge and Cecil Edwards of mixed
Cecil
letters.
Edwards and Burbidge, if I had any.
Right, the motion.
No, I thought about it.
That's just fine. They'll probably agree with you, frankly, and that'll be the end of it. But if they don't, I'd like to have them have an opportunity to work with you. I think it's too broad as it is. It has to be tightened in some respect, and maybe three of you can decide. That's my thought.
Motion is table. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Madam Chairman?
Yes.
There's a bill that you may have had a hearing on it, and I don't know. I may have been absent when you did. But it's Senate Bill 748 that I'd like to have you take a minute on. It's a good bill, really. It's one that the thing came up at an American trial lawyer.
Just a minute. Let me look at it.
Who's the sponsor of it?
Cook.
Oh, well, it must be.
We had a hearing on it.
Pardon?
Have you had a hearing?
I don't remember.
No,
I missed. You haven't. It's a purely a lawyer's thing, and I don't think really anyone would object. Can I explain it?
Yes, go ahead.
748, the idea came to me after attending an American trial lawyers conference.
John, have we had a hearing on it?
No, we haven't.
Has it ever been posted for hearing?
No, it hasn't.
Well, make it brief, because we're not going to do anything with it until we've had a hearing.
Well, can we say, would John put it on for a hearing? Because it is a good bill. It's a lawyer's bill. It has to do with the way of exercising peremptory challenges. What it does is eliminate the bad ones. You have your panel, and they start at the back end and back into, and what's left is the jury.
Okay, John's putting on for a hearing.
So, I don't know.
862. John?
This bill would broaden the sources from which county clerks would draw individuals to make up the jury list. It was introduced as a result of a letter indicating that a person took his name from the voter registration list because he was being called all too frequently to be on a jury. And the particular citizen thought that having simply the voter registration list deterred some people from exercising their right to vote by registering. There are two people who testified against the bill. One was Mike Hall. He indicated that it was his understanding that utility customer lists were not organized according to county. Ted DeLuce from the Revenue Department testified against it, mainly from the standpoint that he thought that state personnel income tax rolls should be deleted, raising the problem of confidentiality of these particular rolls. I think that you could, if you wished, leave that on. I don't think the confidentiality statutes prohibit such use. They begin by, except as otherwise specifically provided by law, it shall be unlawful to disclose these things. It's mainly, in my view, a matter of policy as to whether or not you want to do this. It is, as I understand it, the policy of the Department of Revenue and the opinion of the Attorney General that unless there is some other law which allows for disclosure, the confidentiality statutes do prohibit the disclosure of the names of persons who do file income tax returns. So as I say, I think that you can do it legally. It's a question of whether or not you wish to as a matter of policy. One other suggestion I might make was, I think Mike Hall made this suggestion, that perhaps because of the burdensomeness of requiring that all of these particular lists be used, you might require that a voter registration list be used and one of these others which you might wish to leave in the bill.
Senator Carson.
That was the point I was going to make, that I think, if I recall the testimony, is that if we require all these, that the financial burden would be really very heavy. But if we broadened it by allowing them the opportunity to use, I think the suggestion was, as John has indicated, to use registration list and then one other, and I'd kind of think maybe use voter registration list required and then perhaps supplement it by one or more of the other choices. It doesn't get at the problem that the person, there was testimony about those that don't want to register because they don't want to be on the jury. As long as we use, as long as the voter, we'd have to eliminate it as a technique in order to
get at the problem raised by the question about he didn't want to register because he didn't want to be on the list. I don't think providing an alternative, the counties are going to continue using the voter registration list. It's too easy to change. And I think to get at that problem, we had to eliminate it, and I don't think we dare do that.
We really don't need the bill. They actually have all the authority they need right now under the existing language. Mm-hmm. Voter registration list or any other source which will furnish a fair cross-section of the county.
I think you just undone me. Yes, I think you're right.
Chair moves table bill.
Quick follow up.
Brown?
No.
Carson?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Travis?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
And Chairman?
Aye.
Or from any other source. I'll change my vote to aye.
Reaction. 884.
Aye on that.
Did you hear Walt Brown?
Madam Chairman, this was a bill on which Senator Burbidge wished to testify. Basically, what it does is increases the governor's authority to subpoena and depose witnesses or subpoena evidence. Currently, if you look down on lines 16 through 25...
Has he testified on this before?
No, he hasn't. No one testified at the time.
Well, maybe we better send for him and go to another House Bill 2277. Is somebody sending for him?
Which bill are you on that?
2277.
I think you should have in your packet a mocked up version of the bill as amended, which is a little bit easier to look at. Take that back. I guess it's in the binders. This bill would prohibit employers from discharging or intimidating or coercing employees in order to prevent them from serving as jurors. Subsection 2 makes it clear that if there is some agreement between the employees and the management, which evidently there are such agreements negotiated by unions, that this particular section would not affect those agreements. It requires the sheriff to notify jurors of their rights under this particular section. And it also provides that a juror who is discriminated against or, excuse me, who is discharged or so on under this, against this particular section may seek injunctive relief. And in addition to that, can get back pay for the time that he was discharged. It also allows for a civil penalty in Section 2, which must be initiated by a district attorney. We had testimony from a representative of the American Civil Liberties Union, and in your packets there should be a suggested amendment which would allow an employee a private right of action against an employer if he were adversely affected by a decision of the employer based upon the employee serving as a juror. The suggested amendment would allow punitive damages even though there are no actual damages, and the extent of the damages are to be measured by the trier of fact. It would also allow attorney fees. If you look at Section 3, which is part of the amendments made by the House, you'll see that not only the person, but also the person's employer can seek to have a person not on jury service if there's going to be an extreme inconvenience or undue hardship to either the person or the person's employer.
Wasn't that made here in the Senate?
We discussed that. There are two bills besides this House bill in our committee that relate to the same subject matter. And we just, in hearing and talking about the Senate bills, we discussed this particular, or doing something similar to this.
I'm familiar with cases where they call teachers right in the middle of the school year, which I think is almost unconscionable when they have summers that they could be called.
I think that
section 3 seems to appeal to me.
I think that that would take care of that.
I can't find the amendments you're talking about in section 3.
It's a long John.
Oh, that. Okay.
This markup is the House amendment?
Yes.
Madam Chairman, I just think they're going a little bit too far. I don't want the person who serves on the jury discriminated against. And certainly, if there's a question of deduction, A, you ought to have the opportunity to get that. I'm not so sure we ought to give him the club punitive damages on.
It's not in the bill here. That's the proposed amendment. Why don't we just send the bill out in its present form? I move the bill out
without punitive damage.
I might add, Madam Chairman, there is in Section 2 this civil penalty, which may be similar to punitive damages.
Well, it's discretionary with the court, is it?
Yeah.
What's the injunctive relief purpose?
Mainly if, say, an employee, for instance, if, let's assume, say, that an employee is summoned to jury duty, and the employer says, if you go on this jury duty, I'm going to fire you. The employee who wants to go on jury duty could go to the court to enjoin the employer from firing him if he...
Well...
Or... Also, I suppose to join him from further intimidating or coercing the employee with regard to serving on a jury.
He has the opportunity now to go to the court showing hardship or extremely.
They can do that now to get off of it. This would retain that. I mean, this was our idea when we discussed this bill here originally. It was very personal, and like someone like Betty or maybe Wally and myself, you have a one or two person law office, and here they come in and want your secretary to serve for a month. Well, there isn't, you can't just can't pick up someone to come in for a month to serve as a legal secretary. It's not like hiring someone to dig a pit. It could doggone near bankrupt you. And so that was the reason why we talked about this amendment that's in here, where you come in and say, like I did, my secretary was called to jury duty for March of this year.
I'm not so sure I want you to have injunctive.
No, it wouldn't give me injunctive. I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying that you need a way to get out, for a person to get out. And this gives it
other than praying to the court that you should be relieved, that's what you're
saying.
Right. They might say, it's going to be a good experience for this legal secretary to be on a jury for a month.
Yeah, well, you go broke, and there's no job to come back to. But anyhow, that's in the bill here.
Touching my heart.
Well, you ought to be a lawyer who has only one person that knows anything about it and try to bring in. I went through hell for about a year and a half with one incompetent secretary after another, and doggone near ruined me. You get a bad secretary, it can break you.
She runs the office.
Even Lauren, I think, could testify to that. Maybe he's never been in that position.
Or said
Keith, I didn't see it. What's your pleasure with this bill?
I said I'd move 2277 out the way it is.
What do you mean, as amended by the House?
As amended by the House.
Yeah,
without the other proposed punitive.
Is there going to be really enforcement under Section 2? Has that really protected?
Well, it has a civil penalty.
Yes,
here.
But really, can you get the district attorney to bring
that
sort of a
Well, I suppose if the district attorney is doing his duty, I mean, we have to assume he's going to abide by the law. It isn't always true.
May bring an action. You can't even bring a mandamus against him to bring an action. He may.
Well, sure you could.
Bring a mandamus
sure you
him.
Could bring a mandamus against the district attorney.
Well, not when he's required. He's discretionary in his part to bring it. He may bring an action to enforce a civil penalty. Doesn't have to.
Well, they don't have to bring one as a family fight either. You have a hell of a time getting them to do it. But, you can't have perfection, you know. It's better than the present law. The present law doesn't give a juror any.
I move to amend your motion to put in the section 2 on the bottom of the mock-up we have, which has the do-it-yourself suit by the voter.
Let's see.
That's the any employee who has been discharged shall have a right of action against the employer. That's the one that Bob feels is going too far.
The motion is to include section 2 of the mock-up we have of House Bill 2277.
As substitute for the other two.
As substitute for the other section 2.
And the section 4, the subsection 4 in section 1. It's now a substitute for this, but a substitute for that, those two.
Which is the right bill, the mock-up bill?
The bill that's in your binder there is the bill, the mock-up bill. That's as it came into the committee from the House.
Yeah, he's talking about some other mock-up.
The amendment should be in your packet, looks like this.
And what was the source of the amendment?
The ACLU.
Oh, okay. Any question about what the amendment is?
The amendment would knock out subsection 4 of section 1 of the House bill, or knock out section 2 of the House bill, and substitute section 2 of the ACLU bill.
Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. I should declare my conflict of interest. I'm a member of the ACLU.
So what?
No.
Roberts?
No.
Smith?
I think he said no. Aye. The motion fails. Senator Cook moves to...
I didn't understand your motion. What was your motion?
It was a
do-it-yourself. It was to take this section 2 right here.
Add punitive.
That's a little shorty.
Oh.
You would have voted against.
The
punitive damages? Oh, yeah. Senator Cook moves to send House Bill 2277 out as it arrives. Discussion.
Can I ask a question of somebody that has some experience? You're taking out language in Section 3, which provides he doesn't have to serve when he's over age 70, when his health is about to die, and when his family requires his absence.
Well, I think that's covered really in lines 12 through 14. That will cover a multitude of sins.
I understand that, but we have that same language was in subsection C.
Well, this is broader up there, let's see, or maybe it's broader.
Extreme
hardship to the person, including but not limited to unusual and extraordinary financial hardship. Well, and this also brings in the employer. Up there, it only affects the employee. This would be a hardship and to that person or his employer. So an employer, I don't think there's any provision now for an employer coming in, but then up until now the employer could say to his secretary, now go try to get off of that jury. Now we're saying the employer can't say to his secretary, go try to get off of that jury, so we need this new language here in one to give the employer the right to petition the court.
I'm with Bob, I'm not sure that 1 and 2 is covered of the old language about the health and the family.
Madam Chairman,
John,
I think I would think that the new sub 1 does cover everything, although you're not going to get an automatic excuse if you're 70. Over 70.
Yeah, I don't
but
think
if
they
if say you're in ill health, I think certainly that would come under the new 1.
Okay, I'm sold.
Further discussion on the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Then we have two other bills which are closely similar to this, 109 and 226.
I don't know about that.
And we need to table those.
So move 109.
Move to table 109. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Halleck consented to that. Go ahead.
Aye.
He votes aye.
Aye.
226, and this is Senator Burbidge. Senator Burbidge, we just sent out a bill against discriminating against a juror. It's a House bill. Is it all right if we table yours? Betty Roberts moves to table 226. Quick call the roll.
Everybody votes aye.
That's right. Move on.
All right. Keith, what's the number of your bill?
884.
What?
884.
Okay, 884.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to move it out. You want to listen to Keith first?
Yeah, I'd like to hear what Keith has.
That's an active position to put a guy in. The bill's on its way out unless you want to testify.
You couldn't start it.
God, I can't. I'm doing a lot of other things. If my testimony is going to make Senator Cook or anybody else nervous, I'd be glad to disappear right now.
Does anybody have any questions of Senator Burbidge?
Well, isn't this basically, Madam Chairman, to give the governor the authority to obtain information about the shortage of energy? And there's a question about whether he had that authority before. Apparently, he didn't.
Under the law that was passed in the 1974 special session, he had the power only during an officially proclaimed emergency. And now, giving the authority to get that, you need to make an amendment, which this bill will do.
But still only during an emergency?
No. Give him the authority to subpoena necessary energy resource information at any time. Necessary resource information.
Where does it say necessary?
In my statement.
Oh, pretty quick.
Keith, right here.
Senator Brown.
Keith, in the Energy Department bill before, that has come out of...
It's up on line five, as a matter of fact.
Sure it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Keith, in the Energy Department bill that has come out of the, our Senate Energy and Environment Energy Committee, it seemed to me that this particular section was touched upon.
That was going to be my next point to you, Senator.
Conflict, I think.
Others, and that was, that's my understanding from some research that we've done, that there is that other bill.
883, I think it is.
No, it's a House bill. No, it's a Senate bill. And it's in the Ways and Means Committee. It is 483, Senate Bill 483.
483, okay.
That's in Ways and Means. After that bill passes, maybe the committee ought to hold this bill till that other bill passes to make sure that they're properly compatible there.
What's the number of that bill?
483. It's in Ways and Means.
Do you know that it's going to pass?
No, I don't know that. That's why this bill will be necessary if that one doesn't pass.
Well, it passed this one first, and then if that one passed, they can...
Well, certainly your judgment there is probably better than mine.
Senator Garza.
Madam Chairman, I think, if I read it correctly, Keith, that what you're trying to do, or what the bill tries to do, is grant any time authority for only the one item of inventory or of energy resources, and that's all. The emergency authority continues as it was passed in '74.
Governor has to know what there is out to make decisions.
Well...
In view of the shaky nature of 483, it's always shaky.
Senator Smith.
I move it.
Well, Madam Chairman, I understand inventory. I know what he wants. He wants to find out how much gas is in the tanks by the companies, but by the same token, there's a lot to look at logs of all geothermal drillers or any other for his own purposes at any time. I just... The inventory of an energy resource is sometimes a very sensitive question. And
knowledge of an inventory, of course, is a very sensitive question.
The motion has been to send Senate Bill 884 out to pass. Further discussion? Quick call roll.
Aye.
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 Roberts.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Matt.
Aye. Senate.
A lot happier with it, it's a gas line or something.
Senate.
Down to the point, kind of thing.
Senate Bill 803. Judge Hicks?
I was just here if there was any question.
John?
Madam Chairman, there is a one-page summary of this bill in your packet. I think it does actually hit the major changes on the first page there. Basically, it's a revision of the laws which have to do with appointing pro tem judges or assigning existing judges to other positions temporarily. It's an attempt to bring all of the statutes into one section or one group of statutes.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Is under the present law, is a circuit court automatically a pro tem district court judge and vice versa?
No.
No. Is there any...
Yeah, there's an absence of an emergency to the statute that gives them the authority to act for each other in certain limited areas where there's somebody not... No judge present.
Could I just...
Not in this bill.
But isn't it, I just want to amplify, I do mean to interrupt and I apologize, but is not true that Byrne said automatic? It's not automatic, but it's close to being automatic, because isn't it annually, doesn't the Supreme Court appoint almost all district court judges as pro tem circuit court judges? They used to, and I don't know.
They don't
have.
No.
They don't.
They can, and we only do that if the circuit judge, the resident circuit judge, requests that his district judge be appointed. Of them do.
But only
a few. But it's definitely not automatic. It's not.
All right. Now, does the Supreme Court have the authority without limit as to duration of time to appoint district court judges pro tem circuits and circuit court judges pro tem district?
That's done usually for a year at a time.
The limit, in other words, we do have a limit on non-judges, their appointment as pro tem. I mean,
90 days.
90 days. We passed out a bill that would repeal it. I don't know, it's over in the House.
No, we did.
No, that repealed the limitation of a person serving more than, could not serve more than 180 days. Now a lawyer could serve the pro tem full time, but his appointment would have to be renewed formally every 90 days.
All right, now, did that pass both houses now?
Yes.
Has the governor signed it?
I'm sure he has.
We're going to have trouble with sub 2 on the summary. And pass that other bill first.
All right, now,
that was one of the things that came up in discussion of that bill before.
One of the...
Senator Cook.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to get us closer to a single level court, and I wonder, and I don't know how to do it, and I was thinking maybe we should provide maybe a way to do that.
That's rather a revolutionary change in
this
bill.
Well, it's a minority report in the Judicial Council. They're very...
It's a little cleanup bill.
Yeah, I was going to say, there goes the judge's cleanup bill. Parts is a sensitive
subject.
Madam Chairman?
Senator Carson.
While we're pondering that issue, in light of our discussion on SJR 9 and a variety of other things, I was really surprised to read how many counties or judicial districts do use pro tem circuit court judges or district court. What's the screening process? It seems to me that we're...
To appoint the individual.
Why don't you come up to the table so we can pick you up on the table?
Well, let me tell you my concern, and that is that the legislature made a judgment some years ago, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, rather than to put in a number of circuit judges,
or district judges primarily, they put in the pro tem, they fund the pro tem bit and see how they worked on that. And I'm surprised to find out how many of my colleagues are either pro tem district or pro tem circuit, not so much circuit in Marion County, but in other counties, I understand. And I have no axe to grind. I'm not thinking of any person particularly why he is sitting as a judge, but I'm surprised. It doesn't seem to be any order or criteria or standards. And after all the trouble we've been through on SJR 9 and a variety of other things, it seems to me this is a broadening area where we're moving into an appointed judge system. He does not stand election, and there is no qualification or criteria for selection that I'm aware of. Now, maybe you can put my mind at ease.
Well, there's qualifications are in the present statute that he retained in this bill. They must be a member of the Oregon State Bar, must have been such for 3 years, and they must have the same qualifications otherwise as a regular judge would have.
Yeah, but
the criteria that is appointed, the appointment is based on, is the Supreme Court will not appoint anybody who is not requested or approved by the judge who needs the assistance. And we ask that that judge get the recommendation from the bar, especially if it's somebody who's going to serve quite often, that they go to the Bar Association, either have a committee from the bar or some way that the bar approves that the person is serving is acceptable to the practicing bar. And he must be acceptable to the other judges. And occasionally we've appointed somebody who went to a district and did not fare very well with the other judges or with the bar, and there was objections to him, and he was never reappointed. We review every 3 months the who has been assigned and how many days they've been working. The whole idea is to get individuals who are acceptable as judges, and mostly they are people of considerable experience, especially at the circuit court. We almost always appoint only experienced trial lawyers who can go into a courtroom and immediately assume the duties of a judge without having to go through a training period or a learning period. And many of the people that are serving probably wouldn't take a regular position because they couldn't afford it, but they kind of like to do it occasionally. That's especially true of the circuit court. The district court, we sometimes get the younger people who are working their way up and have ambition someday to be a judge, and this is a chance for old experience and exposure.
How many pro tem judges do we have at any given time now that are...
Well, we're using, and just not by people, individuals, but the equivalent of about 9.5 district judges around the state. In 1974, the days of service given equal 9.5 district judges and about 3.5 circuit judges.
How many people have we, do you have any idea how many have been certified?
That'd be more difficult. We probably have a list of maybe 20-some lawyers who are approved by the Supreme Court to be circuit judges, and maybe twice that long or even more than that who are approved to be district judges. We try to use the same people rather regularly rather than just somebody now and then, just so they get the experience and get established as a judge in the community. Also, we do not appoint anybody to any court if he's trying cases in that court. They must be people who are either not practicing in that court or are willing to cease practicing in the court. So sometimes they have to travel. We use Salem lawyers in Portland quite a bit for that reason. But yet we try to avoid the travel expense. And sometimes we'll get a judge or a lawyer to serve in the district court because he only practices in the circuit court. If there is a jury used in both courts, like Lane County, for instance, there we don't use them in either court if they're trying cases in either of the courts because they might appear in front of the same jury panel.
Mm-hmm. Multnomah County has the same thing, but we have the same panel there. Do we not? In Multnomah County, I think so. Same jury panel.
I believe you do. I believe there they can serve in either court. Almost all of the attorneys we're using as pro tems in Multnomah County, either around outside the county, or we have one man there who is serving full time and he does not practice, do any trial work at all.
Who is that?
Don Launder.
We used to have that old guy who was Galton's father. His name wasn't Galton. He used to be up there for years. Goldstein. He was on for a long while, and he died.
And then we use retired judges whenever we can. The criteria is if a judge calls in and needs help next week or next month, we first go to the other judges to see if they can spare some time. If they can't, then we go to our retired judges and see if they're available. If we can't get a retired judge, then we call our pro tem list.
One more question. Do you think now, and I'm not necessarily going to try to amend this bill, but do you think now that the Constitution has been amended to allow the a charge to be brought on information in the circuit court rather than having to go to the grand jury, that the, do you agree with me that the last major constitutional impediment to the merger of the district and the circuit court has kind of vanished now? I mean, I thought before that really either you could have a real problem, possibly, unless you use the pro tem device in setting up a single circuit court, because under the old law, every charge would have to go before the grand jury unless there were consent. Now that's been eliminated by this amendment that no longer requires everything to go before the grand jury, so there seems to me there is no longer any constitutional impediment to having simply departments of the circuit court.
I haven't really researched it, but I don't think there is. I think it would be a matter of statute.
Would a 12-man jury be required if you went to strictly circuit court, or do we have constitutional authority to, for a 6-man jury in circuit court?
I think you could.
Do you think you have that now? Was that in the Constitution, too? Do you know, Mick, was it?
Sure, no.
Well, that was
the amendment, but I'm not sure.
The amendment was to make the district court possibly a court of record and retain a 6-man jury. I think that's all it did was say the person entitled to the jury trial, at least 6 people, was applied to either court or any court.
You think that the Constitution was amended?
Without going back and researching it, I haven't studied it, but that's my impression.
What's the importance of passing this bill?
It's mainly to help us administer the pro tem program and to assign judges from one place to another. Now they are appointed under various rules, and that we have to keep explaining to people that they're looking at the wrong section, and just it's administrative. Also, there's some unhappiness because all judges are paid the equivalent of the court they're working on, except district judges who work at the circuit court level get only district court pay, and this would make their morale a little better, and I think be fairer. And we have to now send copies of the appointments and the oaths to the Oregon State Bar Office, to the Secretary of State, and I don't think there's any, they just file them away and there's no reason for them to have them.
No, it's the evidence.
So it would save all that paperwork and mailing of extra copies, and they're having to maintain a file on it.
I move 803 out to pass.
I have qualifications about that sub 2. Does anybody else? The second one on the summary.
What page is that on?
Your summary. The second shit. Item on your summary.
Where is that?
Does that handle the problem the district judges receive the pay of the circuit court judge when they're serving a pro tem?
Well, that's just what I
that's what you just talked about.
That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. It seems like that's what 2 is addressed to, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it addressed to attorneys appointed to the district court?
Well, that's the case with attorneys now. Any
they do
attorney,
receive district court pay?
If an attorney serves in the district court, he receives 1/20th per day of the monthly salary of the district court judge. You take his monthly salary, divide by 20, and that's the daily compensation for the attorney.
Okay.
This change is, the only change would be that a district court judge who is assigned by the Supreme Court to serve on the circuit court would get that little bit more per day, that the difference between the circuit court daily salary and the circuit court daily salary.
All right. The motion is to send Senate Bill 803 out. John, have you checked it?
Yes, I have.
Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Cook. Aye.
Robert.
Aye.
Aye. On SJR 48, which we passed out, the Judicial Conference, where is it, Court? It's in the other book, I suppose.
Yeah, it is.
It's passed out. Judge Hicks, do you want to go through what they wanted for an amendment?
Saturday morning, the judicial conference discussed this measure at some length.
It's the bill for suspending by the judicial.
Yes.
The one we amended yesterday?
Yeah, I guess it's not in our books, it's out.
The conference discussed it practically line by line, and the result of their discussion and the vote taken and the directions to me to inform the committee of their action were as follows. On line 8, they voted to remove that language or by such other agency as the law may provide.
Considered done.
Yeah, okay. And on line 12, the direction was that, or the recommendation from the conference was to restore willful misconduct in a judicial office involving moral turpitude. And
to delete the new language?
Yeah. To restore the old language and to delete line 13, which is the new language. Conduct in judicial office bringing the judiciary into disrepute. They were concerned about what kind of action brings the judiciary into disrepute, and some of them felt that sometimes good performance would be unpopular and therefore bring the judiciary into disrepute.
We took
so
care
they
of that
were afraid
too.
Of that.
No, I don't.
Other than that, they wanted the bill exactly as it is, except on line 18, they felt that "and dangerous" should be included between narcotic and drugs because of the recent statutes passed differentiating.
You want to take another look at the bill before we send it down?
Yeah.
All right, we'll look at it tomorrow then. And if Judge Hicks, if you could get us those items in writing by tomorrow, we'd appreciate it.
And I sent you a letter,
you did?
Madam Chairman. Did you receive that?
I don't think we have yet, Madam Chairman.
You sure? I sent it over yesterday afternoon by courier.
I
well,
haven't got it.
We'll have to have
it. Well, I'll be sure that you have it. It's a letter and another copy of this bill showing the effect. I'll double check and make sure it's here. Thank you.
Senate Bill 889. Nita Bell has testified on it. If you remember, her amendment was to strike district courts in Section 2 and substitute municipal courts. Justice courts shall have the same civil jurisdiction as municipal courts.
Well, that's kind of silly.
Well, it's to allow municipal courts to contract with justice courts. Some of them want to do as they've done in Portland and contract for services and get out of the court business.
Well, I'm not sure that that's the way to do it. Who has actually checked that out? Shall have this. Justice courts shall have the same civil jurisdiction. Now, what did we as district courts, now we allow contracts between cities, or we allow, and not contracts now, there's a contract provision, but there's also a provision that a charge may be brought in a district court. That was the bill I got passed last time. A city charge may, if the city attorney chooses to, be brought, I'm quite sure it's in the district court, isn't it?
We don't have any district.
Right.
All right, what I'm suggesting is that this language might be all right. In other words, you say, what I think should be done is to take the Hoyt bill, which I plagiarized last time, got passed in 73, that allows a city attorney to bring a charge in district court, and simply make it clear that a justice court may be used in the same way that a district court may now be used.
Yeah, but that's on the volition of the individual.
City attorney. No, it's the city attorney.
All right, the city attorney. And what this provides is a contractual agreement.
Well, we've got a provision for a contract somewhere else.
The justice court.
Someone challenged that one time.
That same amendment would have to be made on line 22.
Well, I'm just questioning whether the way you're proposed to do it is right.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I might also add that if we make that amendment, changing it to just or to municipal courts, it's not necessary to repeal 51080. That's the statute which currently specifies what the justice's court's jurisdiction is.
She's taking that out.
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
Okay.
Well, he's taking out lines 5 through 8.
I don't think you want to. There's something wrong with that proposal. Municipal courts don't necessarily have jurisdiction to do anything except to consider city ordinances. And you don't want to limit the. If this does limit the justice court, you don't want to limit them just to considering city ordinances.
Take a look at this again.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with that. And that's essentially what we've done with the district court.
That's the amendment.
The Hoyt Cook bill last time. I don't know what bill. Do you know where that is?
No, it was the one Carson tried in 69. So it's the Hoyt
Carson
Cook.
Hoyt.
Carson.
Formerly Carson.
That's where I learned to keep the names off the bills I wanted.
Senator Smith moves the Anita Bowles amendments to Senate Bill 889.
Well, I'd like to have, if you don't mind, I'd like to have John check
this language against the language conferring this jurisdiction to the district court.
That's fine.
Be sure that it's
ready. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
I think
it's just
House
that
Bill
you guys don't have to face Anita Bowles.
2494 Deal Ward wants to be held on. So that's all the business we have.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm interested in making district courts a court of record. Is anybody else?
I'm interested in having a single level of. Let's use that bill to have a single
level
of.
I'm interested
in making district courts a court of record. Is there anybody else interested in it on that committee?
Only in that way, and I'll be happy to work with you. Make them courts. We'll create one level and we'll make all the district court judges. We'll set a time when we'll have one level of judge. All the district court judges will have to run for re-election as circuit court judges. What I'm trying to say is, yes, district court, there should be records on all levels,
okay.
But there should be one level of
I'm
judge.
I'm not interested in that. I want to know if you're interested in the bill that's in here.
We're going to work on 2 and 248 together at the same time.
Okay.
Mick?
Forgive me, I wrote you a note about 890. I wondered if you might be willing to let me make that point to the committee.
890.
You had, I think it was 890. You went through it.
980.
Or 980, whichever way it ran. You had
well,
three votes one way, three the other, and I.
All right, make
the
point.
Point might make a difference.
It's Tom Mahoney's bill.
Well,
it needs one more vote.
It only needs one more vote to go somewhere, and my concern is that it might. I'd like to at least.
Go ahead.
Get my shot in. The point I wanted to make was the bill would deny a police officer the right, among other things, to make a probable cause arrest for driving under the influence. Half of the arrests for driving under the influence are made on probable cause, and if he can't arrest, then he can't require the breathalyzer test, which loses any chance of being carried. One car accident, two car accident, whatever. If he didn't see it himself, he can't make the arrest. And that's inconsistent, I think, with what you've done with SB1, and I'm not real sure the committee would want to do that. Granted, the police sometimes abuse their arrest authority.
Senator Brown.
Renew my motion table.
<Meeting's correct. laughs>